Welcome to the Far and Beyond podcast, hosted by the Contracts and Fiscal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. This podcast is for the federal government attorneys navigating the complex intersection of acquisitions and fiscal law and policy. I am your host, Major Ellie Sewell.
I'm Major Ed Callahan.
And together we are your co-hosts. On this episode of Far and Beyond, we have a special guest with us from the Government Accountability Office, Mr. Edward Goldstein.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me. My name is Edward Goldstein. I'm one of the Managing Associate General Counsels at GAO in charge of the bid protest team, what we call the Procurement Law Group, within the Office of General Counsel. I manage that team with my co-manager, Ken Patton, and together we oversee all the bid protest decisions at GAO. I started my legal career as a JAG attorney in the Army back in 1999. Went through the JAG basic course, and served for 4 years with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, working in their government contracts group, which is where I got first exposed to bid protests. After finishing there, my service obligation, I went to the Court of Federal Claims and clerked for a judge over there, Judge Seipolt. Worked on a variety of cases to include bid protests at the Court of Federal Claims. And then a spot opened up at GAO, and I started there in 2003, and I've been there ever since. It's been a great experience. It's one of those practice areas where it's sort of a inch wide, a mile deep, doing just bid protests for that time. But, you know, you really get deep into it, and I still think that there's always something new coming along. When you think you've seen it all, there's something new. There's a new twist on a procurement that keeps things interesting.
What an interesting field to get in. It's also nice to meet someone else who joined in 99. I enlisted in November of 99. I had my little break in service, and here I am back in uniform. So I really appreciate you coming in and kind of sharing some wisdom gained over time, especially welcome back to the JAG schoolhouse that I'm sure was your regimental home for quite a period of time there.
It's always great to come back.
Mr. Goldstein, thank you so much for joining us and coming to talk with us. I understand that we have some new reports hot off the press today.
Yes, actually, on Monday, GAO issued its annual report on bid protests. And we have all the stats covering the FY25 cases that were filed. We have a report of one agency that did not follow one of GAO's recommendations in a protest. And just all the tidbits of information that everyone likes to see and pontificate about with regard to the cases that were filed, what's happening at GAO, where are protests going in the future.
So this is great. And we really appreciate, like Ellie said, you coming and talking to us. And you just put on a great presentation in our new developments course. So following up with some of that, and before we get into the more specific caseload, I'm wondering if you could take a step back and how did this year or how did 2025 compare to past years? Are you seeing any big picture trends in protests going up, down, more being sustained, more corrective action? Is there anything you're seeing from kind of your level as far as the trend goes?
So I think this year was emblematic of a overall trend, which started in around 2015, 2016, of protests continuing to go down.
Okay.
At GAO. This year was down about 6% from last year. I think we had about 1,688 cases filed in FY25, which was down from around 1,800 last year. While the numbers have been trending down, what has remained consistent has been what we call the sustain rate, which is the cases in which we find that an agency may have made an error and we find the protest had merit. And this year it was around 14% of the merit decisions that we issued resulted in a sustained protest. And then the other metric that's remained rather consistent is what we call the effectiveness rate, which this year was about 52%. Effectiveness rate really measures what we call a combination of sustains and agency corrective action. That's where agencies voluntarily, corrective action occurs when an agency voluntarily decides that a protest may have merit, there may have been an error with the procurement, and they pull back the procurement decision for a reevaluation or some sort of corrective action. And when you look at that combined with sustains, of all the cases that we resolved over the course of the year, over half of them are resulting in either corrective action or a decision by GAO that there was an error in the procurement.
So even though the raw number of protests has been going down in, like you said, a general trend for, sounds like, the last 10 years, the actual effective rate has remained more or less the same at a little over half of them getting either corrective action or a decision or a favorable decision from GAO?
That's exactly right. And I think it speaks to the fact that GAO protests remain a vehicle for identifying errors in procurements. And it's fairly effective in the sense that, I mean, we use the word effectiveness rate for that reason, in the sense that it's targeting those procurements and raising issues about procurements, and half the time there's some identification of an error, which is a pretty good statistic.
It's at least a good use of GAO's time if they're getting that many of them that are getting effective outcomes based on the process.
So we just talked about the overall statistics for GAO. What about the Department of War specifically? What are we seeing there?
So we're seeing a similar trend overall in terms of filings being down. Actually, the sustain rate is identical for DOD as it is with overall when you combine both civilian agencies and Department of Defense agencies. And the effectiveness rate is actually a little bit lower for DOD procurements at 48%, but it's still hovering around 50%. The one thing I would note that for DOD, the number of cases that were filed this year was 764, which is less than half of our overall caseload.
Oh, wow.
Which for a long time, DOD represented more than half of GAO's docket. And as we've been trending down in our cases, the drop has actually been more precipitous with DOD procurements and protests of DOD procurements.
So has the civilian agencies then kind of just stayed the same, but it's just DOW keeps dropping?
They both have gone down a bit, but DOD has gone down more at a faster rate than civilian agencies. We noted that in our, we put together a report to Congress this past year where Congress asked for a proposal for what we call loser pay and to do a couple other things. But we wanted to give Congress some context of where protests stood overall and the numbers and the downward trend in protests generally.
So that's interesting. And I remember reading something about there being more and more concerns, at least at the congressional level and at the policy level, about trying to address the frivolous protests that are coming through. Do you track ones that are dismissed on those grounds? And has that number gone up, down, or are there any trends? Or is that not something that you all track internally, the grounds for dismissal?
So we don't track what we call, quote unquote, frivolous protests. We do dismiss protests for jurisdictional questions, issues of timeliness, and then also where they fail to state what we call a valid basis of protest.
Mm-hmm.
We don't actually track those numbers per se.
Okay.
We don't publish those. But we don't typically go down the road of trying to identify protests or quote-unquote frivolous. And part of it is because we think that the failure to present a state of valid basis of protest is sufficient since we're dismissing those usually fairly quickly in the process, usually within the first 30 days or so of a protest that's been filed.
So with the DOW protest going down, especially in comparison to other agencies kind of staying the same or maybe even going up a little bit, but at least the DOW share going down. Do you and the GAO have any thoughts as to why that would be or what that trend points to?
So we're not certain, but one of the things that we're thinking about that may be the cause is the use of enhanced debriefings, which may be resulting in protesters not filing when they get more information. The idea is that the more information they have, it prevents what we call defensive protests or protests just to get more information about why they lost. The other theory is behind enhanced debriefings is it extends out the period for filing a protest and creates more of a cooling off period where protesters don't have a knee-jerk reaction. When they're under very tight timeframes to file, they may not be in the position to make the best decisions. But as that period extends out, they may have a time to sort of absorb it, think about what their options are, and potentially think, I lost this one, but now I can put my resources towards going for another procurement.
And I remember that being one of the discussion points on the enhanced debriefings being, perhaps if we're communicating better, they don't need to do these protests in order to get the more information that they would want to build the next packet. So it's not even about revisiting this particular bid. But how do I do better on the next one? Previously, it would almost have to go through the bid protest in order to get the reports coming to you. So it's nice to hear that maybe these enhanced debriefings are achieving their goal of better communication leads to less protest down the line.
And we've had an internal debate about this too, I think even on this podcast.
Yeah.
I agree. I think the enhanced debriefings, when I've done them, I feel like we're able to get more information, answer the questions that we can, and they seem calmer than if we wouldn't have given that information. But I know the flip side, some people say they get more information so they have more reason to protest. I don't know. I think if they're going to protest, they're going to protest no matter what. So it depends. So maybe the cooling off period does really help that knee-jerk reaction. We're like, well, we don't know, so let's just file anyways. We only have 10 days to make the decision. Where, yeah, you get that extension. You're like, oh, no, that it would just not. It's not worth it.
The other thing I've been hearing is that agencies, when they're using enhanced debriefing processes, and this is what I've actually heard from some of the civilian agencies when we've been mentioning that enhanced debriefings may be a tool to stave off protests, and that they've used them, that they've had some success. And what they've also been emphasizing is who delivers the message. Having somebody who's really good at effective communication. It doesn't always have to be the contracting officer, but it could be somebody who's really good at effectively communicating the points that need to be made as part of the debriefing process, really enhances that process and really turns it into more of a conversation and a way to really look forward and use it as a process so that the contractor walks away having learned something and gotten something of value from it.
I like that. That makes sense. I wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah, and I worked with three KOs pretty closely when we were doing a lot of these enhanced debriefings. One of them was really good at that conversational tone. He was like, by the end of the conversation, I felt like they were best friends and they're going to go out for a drink afterwards. And then I had another one. She would use her mom voice. And I swear those contractors were like, yes, ma'am, we're so sorry. Next time we'll do better. And then like the third one is a little bit more different. And we did get a few protests on those. It is communication. I think once you make them feel like they got the information, the answers, the questions they had answered, that really does help.
You know, I think at the core, no one really wants to sue their customer,
right?
Which is what a bid protest is.
That's right.
And so finding ways to really sort of bridge that and create sort of a less adversarial environment goes a long way.
Yeah, that's good. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Now, again, if you guys really do a good job, you'll be putting me out of business. So.
Like I said, I think some people, they have it in their mind, they're going to protest, especially as the value of those contracts get higher. Sometimes we prepare anyways. So I want to switch focus because we've talked about AI a lot on this podcast. It's a big push here in the school, but we're also seeing it creep now into GAO cases, even COFC. What is your take on AI, the AI hallucinations, all of that?
So GAO has no concern about AI as a tool. You know, I think we do work that has identified that AI can be very effective and is really kind of something that we're looking forward to using as a future tool. It's still developing. So GAO has no problem with AI as an effective tool for assisting us with whatever activities we're involved with. The problem we have is the misuse of AI in our forum, which has happened now on several occasions with pro se filers. Those are filers that are not represented by counsel. And I think that you look to AI as a quick and easy tool to help them draft their protests. The problem is, and this is a problem that many of us see with AI as a tool, is you have a problem with hallucinations. You have a problem with the information just being simply inaccurate. And what we've seen is that we've had several pro se filers come in and file their protests, and the protest itself is riddled with fictitious B numbers or case citations. We have cases that are purported to represent a particular legal proposition that is completely inaccurate. And the problem is that it's a fundamental waste of time working through all of these errors and deciphering what is real and what is not, what is accurate and what is not.
So let's say, an initial review if you identify what you think are these problems and you're looking up and saying this B number or this case does not match what they're proposing to do, what's GAO's next step at that point? It's not, I would assume, immediate decision time, right?
No. So typically what we do is we'll go to the party and basically ask, say, look, can you explain these citations? We can't find them. Are we missing them? We give them an opportunity to sort of come clean. And sometimes GAO will identify this, and sometimes often agency counsel will sort of point us to the problems with the filing.
File a motion on it?
File a motion, or say identify the concerns, say that, you know, the protest is, the legal cases that are cited don't exist.
It's difficult to respond to a case that doesn't exist.
Exactly. Yeah. And at that point, we also, when they come back, we usually issue a warning. We explain to them that if they identify that they've used AI to help them file, we'll explain the problems with using AI and the fact that it can create these hallucinated citations to the extent they don't already understand that. But we'll make it clear. And we'll also make it clear that if they do it again, they're subject to potential sanction, which might be actual dismissal of their case.
Yeah, and I know GAO even codified that in the Raven Industries decision.
Right. We wanted to make sure we had a published decision which put everyone on notice of the potential pitfalls of using AI without checking your work. And I think that's the key, is not checking the work. Again, AI can be a valid tool. It can be useful. But you need to make sure that what the information that's being presented to the forum is accurate and correct.
And then it all came to a head fairly recently in the O'Reedy O'Ready case, right?
Right. So a few months after Raven Industries, where we kind of put the world on notice that this is a problem, potential problem, and that your party can be sanctioned, we ultimately did dismiss a protest filed by a company called O'Ready for engaging its use of AI. I think they actually didn't indicate that they used AI, but it was readily apparent that a lot of the information was incorrect in their protest filing. And they did it repeatedly, even after being warned. So that was sort of the tipping point at which we decided enough is enough, and we dismissed the protest.
So like you said, even in this case, they received their warnings, they received their opportunities to cure or explain, and didn't.
Exactly. Now, I think they did come back at various points with sort of alternative citations. But again, it was the repeated failure to heed the warning that tipped over the edge to saying, okay, you've abused a process. Your first filings, you know, presented problems, kind of are wasting the time of the forum. And then to do it again, it's not appropriate. And we're just going to dismiss the case out of hand.
And one of the highlighting factors, I think, in those decisions is highlighting the irresponsible use of AI. What would your tips be to, you know, the agencies ourselves who are trying to incorporate AI into more of our practice, but do so responsibly and making sure that we're maintaining our credibility to the GAO, to the COFC, when we sign our name at the bottom? What would be the practice points or the tips that you would put out to the field or put out to practicing attorneys in this field?
And I think it's what all good attorneys do anyway, which is check their work. AI is a tool, but it's a tool that needs close attention. And you just need to do what we always do, which is identify cases, shepherdize them, make sure that they stand for the propositions that we're purporting them to support, and making sure that the information you're providing to a forum is correct and accurate.
I think that's a great and crucial point. And like I said, you see the issues coming from pro se's more than, you know, licensed attorneys or firms coming through. And hopefully that continues to be the case, that attorneys are still acting within our ethical obligations. Yeah,
right.
To do that.
We have not to date seen private attorneys. It's really been the pro se's. And the unfortunate thing about our decisions in this area, ignorance of the law is no excuse.
Right.
Nonetheless, pro se's typically probably are not reading all of our decisions and
sure.
seeing the warnings.
Sure.
But again, which is why I think we're sort of taking a measured approach, giving warnings in cases where right. it's appropriate, and then taking action where we have somebody who's been warned and not heeded those warnings.
Continues to ignore those warnings.
Doubling down.
So, sir, and I'm going to punt a lot of these questions over to Ellie as our subject matter expert in this field, but one of the things that we're encouraging our students to do when we're teaching is to start getting creative with our contract methods and the way that we think about them. And I'm curious if there were any cases that jumped out at you this year that maybe highlight some unique or challenging contracting methods.
Definitely. The one case that stands out to me was a case called S2 Analytical Solutions, which dealt with what we call a situation where the agency is going to hold exchanges with what is identified as the best suited offeror and hold exchanges only with that company. The agencies have a fair amount of latitude when holding what we call exchanges in the context of non-FAR Part 15 procurements. FAR Part 15 has a whole regime devoted to holding discussions. When you're outside of FAR Part 15, there's more flexibility. And agencies for some time have been using what they call the best suited offeror concept in their solicitations, where the agency sets up the ground rules for the procurement and says the government reserves a right to hold exchanges only with the company that's identified as the best suited, kind of what we might consider to be the best value in the procurement, and hold exchanges only with that firm to address a variety of things, technical aspects of their submission or price. And it's almost like a competitive range of one in a FAR Part 15.
Mm-hmm.
We have had a series of cases where companies come in and challenge that. They think it's unfair. You know, they feel like they'll point to the FAR Part 15 rules. The agency should set up a competitive range. The agency should have discussions with a broader range of firms. And typically those cases have been denied because the agency was quite clear when it set up the ground rules for the procurement that it was only going to hold exchanges with the best suited or reserve the right to hold exchanges with just the one company. This year in the S2 Analytical case was the first time where a protester actually challenged the ground rules and said, look, holding exchanges, setting up a system where you hold exchanges with just one offeror is unfair to everybody, and it's not good for the procurement process.
What were they challenging on the grounds? Just like CECA or their...
Well, that was the problem. They were sort of a little bit unmoored. They didn't have anything they could point to. They were pointing to FAR Part 15.
Mm-hmm.
But FAR Part 15 doesn't apply.
Because this was a task order?
This was a task order under a 8.4, so it was a federal supply schedule.
Okay, yep.
And they were also appealing to this idea of fundamental fairness, saying that it's not fair, we're being treated unequally. Ultimately, we denied the protest, and we said that there's no provision in the FAR that would be violated by setting up the process where the agency would limit exchanges to the one firm. FAR Part 15 rules don't apply. And we actually noted that with regard to fairness, the view is that everyone is treated fairly up to the point of being identified as the best suited. So the fact that the agency was going to hold exchanges with just the one firm is not unfair per se. The other thing we noted that given that FSS procurements, task order procurements, are supposed to be more streamlined than a FAR Part 15, it didn't seem to make sense to have a system that actually was more restrictive than a FAR Part 15, where you actually can set a competitive range of one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the best suited offeror is akin to. So we ultimately denied the protest. And it's something for agencies to keep in mind for their solicitations in FSS procurements or FAR Part 16, to consider utilizing process where they're authorizing themselves to hold exchanges with just the best suited. It gives them flexibility. They don't have to only engage with the best suited, but if you go through a process, you've identified the one firm, it has some minor error or something you want to fix, you don't want to hold exchanges with everybody, this gives an agency the flexibility to do that.
That's interesting, but it's good knowledge to have, knowing that there is this ability for flexibility, especially as we're talking, and especially in the DOW, while they're trying to encourage faster acquisitions
in
general. Thank you so much. All of this has been so interesting. Just the numbers and then the cases, AI. It's just, thank you so much for coming down and talking to us about all those issues. Thank you for joining us today in this episode of Far and Beyond. Please make sure to follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform.
As always, we love hearing from all of our listeners, whether or not you run or commute or whatever the situation is that's got you listening to us. Shoot us a message, let us know what you think, and pay attention to the show notes. We're going to link in some of these case references that were brought up today.
The views expressed today are those of the presenters, not that of the Judge Advocate General Corps, the Department of Army, the Department of the Air Force, or the Department of War.